You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a new memoir, Joe Queenan writes that poverty is a tumor that takes a lifetime to excise because poverty is lodged deep inside the brain in a dark corner where the once poor don't want to look. The book, which he's called Closing Time, offers a rough and unsentimental look at Mr. Queenan's hardscrabble youth in Philadelphia, growing up at the mercy of an abusive alcoholic father and an icy mother. It also explains how he was able to eventually escape the legacy of poverty and become a successful humorist, husband, and father, the author of 10 books, including Confessions of a Cineplex Heckler, Celluloid Tirade, and Escapades. Closing Time is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome Joe Queenan back to the show. Hi.
Hi. Great to be back.
You spent a great deal of the book discussing how brutal your father, Joe Sr., was, but you open it with a positive anecdote about him.
Yeah, my father worked for he drove a pretzel truck, and he wasn't in a union. He wasn't a Teamster. He was making a little bit more than the minimum wage. And one night when I was about 13, we had a swinging door in the kitchen, and my little sister, who's 8 years younger than me, was coming towards it, and the door was going to smash her in the face, and she didn't see it. And my dad reached out to grab the door, and he got his fingers caught in the door, and they got all messed up. So we had to take him to the hospital. We had to get a neighbor to take him because we didn't have a car, and they patched him up. And the next day, he woke me up, and he said, "You're taking off from school because you're going out on the truck with me." And I helped him steer that truck all day. I carried all the pretzels and potato chips in and out of the A&P and things like that. He couldn't make a turn without someone helping him. And I start the book talking about that incident because it's the most heroic thing that he ever did.
And it was one of those rare times you could actually bond with him.
It was an amazing thing to do. It also shows that he had to do it because if you didn't show up for work, you lost your job. And then I just say, but days like that didn't happen that often because he drank.
Well, you say that until the later years, he had something of a split personality, depending on whether he'd been drinking or not. But he'd been drinking heavily before he caught his finger in the door.
Yes, he had. He
was and yet he handled this with a certain amount of equanimity.
When you're poor, you learn to tough it out. He drank every day, but he didn't drink on Sundays. And because he didn't drink on Sundays...
Because he went to church?
No, because he thought that you should take Sunday off, and because he thought that if you didn't drink on Sunday, it meant that you weren't an alkie. And that's what he believed. He also believed that if you didn't drink before noon, you weren't an alkie. And what happened in our house was my mother wouldn't let him bring hard liquor into the house, so he would stop off at the tap room first and get about 4 jolts into him, and then... Because he drank so quickly, it got into his nervous system, so that by the time he came home, he was spoiling for a fight.
Did this affect his work record? Because he held many jobs while you were growing up.
You know, I think one year he went through 13 jobs. I mean, he would get a job for 2 days and just quit because people looked at him the wrong way. He was constantly bouncing from job to job. He had a dishonorable discharge from the Army because he had gone AWOL. His parents both died within about 6 weeks of each other, and he couldn't get a pass home, so he went AWOL, and it was very hard to get a good job after that. Dishonorable discharge was a real stigma. So he just bounced from – he was a security guard. He was a truck driver. He sold sandwiches. He just had a maintenance man. He just had jobs like that the rest of his life.
What did he hold on to the longest?
I think he had the job in he worked at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital for 9.5 years towards the end of his life, and then 6 months before he would have been eligible for a pension, he lost his job. And that was it for my parents. After that, my mother finally divorced him. But we were all gone by then.
Your father always seemed to blame Eisenhower and Nixon and the recession of 58 for his long stretches of unemployment.
People in Philadelphia don't like people who have names like Dwight. They don't like guys who golf, and they don't like people who have middle initials. So people didn't like Eisenhower, especially. It was a Democratic city. My father also hated Nixon because of Nixon-Kennedy. We were Kennedy Democrats. And Nixon kept popping up to mess up our lives. In 58, we lost our house. And despite what people write in the newspapers today about how losing a house is no big deal, when you lose your house, you lose your heart. And my father was emasculated when we lost our house, and he was never the same. Nixon popped up again in 68 when I had a scholarship to go to St. Joseph's University. He got elected and he took away all the money from the kids so they would all get shipped to Vietnam. And then in 73, I was in France and I was having such a great time because the dollar was so strong. And he came to Paris, announced that we were going to leave Vietnam. The dollar plummeted. So when he left in 74, I didn't care that much about him undermining democracy. I was just – it was more of a personal, familial thing. I was happy to see the guy go.
He obviously knew that it was going to affect the Queenan family.
My dad always acted as if Richard Nixon was staying up at night figuring out new ways to mess with us.
Your father didn't finish high school, right? But he was very well read.
Yeah, he was a very well-read person, and of course that was part of the tragedy, that he could talk to you about why Thomas A. Becket was murdered. He could tell you why Hannibal went across the Alps. He could explain why the little princes were murdered, and he was spending most of his life with working-class guys who just drank like him but who didn't read books, and this was one of the tragedies, was that he knew that he had thrown his life away. He was a really smart guy. He was also a member of a class that used to exist that doesn't, the working class autodidact. I mean, 30 or 40 years ago, you met lots of guys who only had a high school education, but they read those books about the day Lincoln died, or Bruce Catton books, or Carl Sandburg books. Television just wiped that out.
My father was one of those people, and he tried to go to night school, to college, but he couldn't afford it. He didn't have any money. But our library, which was mostly signed paperbacks, was as good as any library you could find in a house. He was incredibly well-read, and I think that encouraged me to become an autodidact as well.
Yeah, we used to have the bookmobile come around when I was a kid, and you could only borrow 5 books, and I always wanted to borrow 10, because I knew even as a kid, if I want to get out of the working class and get out of the project, I'm going to have to read a lot of books. And that's one of the reasons whenever I am in the presence of wealthy kids who went to prep schools, who went to fancy schools, and they ridicule education, I just take them apart.
Well, don't they also assume, because you are well-read and that you're a success, that you grew up under the same circumstances they did?
When I was writing at Spy, everybody there thought that I'd gone to Harvard. And people would say, like, I remember when you wrote for the Crimson. My daughter went to Harvard. I didn't go to Harvard. I went to St. Joseph's University, which is a very nice school. But in the it used to be journalism was the province of the working class until Watergate. Woodward and Bernstein changed that because it became glamorous to be a journalist. And journalists just kind of naturally assume that if you're in the club, you must have gone to Brown. You must have gone to Dartmouth, at least Duke. You couldn't just come from some little rinky-dink Catholic college in Philadelphia. How'd you get into the club?
Would you even have imagined applying to one of the top schools? Because I think that one of the aspects of class in America is that you just – I never sent an application into Columbia or Yale or Harvard or Brown or any other school. For me, it was going to be Brooklyn College. And then if I went on to grad school, it was going to be Hunter College.
When I was applying to college, it was $10 to apply to Villanova. St. Joe's and LaSalle was $15 to apply to Penn. And I didn't have the $15. And when I talked about that with my dad went ballistic, A, because I was applying to Penn, because that indicated that I thought he was better than him, and B, because it was the $5 extra. But I couldn't have gone to Penn. I couldn't have afforded to go to Penn. And also, you know, when you grow up poor, you don't think of applying out of state. I mean, the idea of like going to school in Washington, D.C. or Boston, it wouldn't even occur to you.
Joe Queenan is the author of 9 books, a regular contributor to the New York Times, and his writing has been featured in Time, Newsweek, GQ, Esquire, People, Forbes, and Rolling Stone, among others. He's written a memoir called Closing Time, and it's published by Viking. The title obviously has a number of different meanings.
Yeah, the title, Closing Time, means, the last round in the bar. It's time to go home, and so that's part of it. But also it's because the book is about how my father and I brought our relationship to an end, because at the end of his life, he would disappear for long periods of time. He would just vanish. We wouldn't know where he was. And when I found out that he was dying of cancer, of multiple forms of cancer, I actually was relieved. I mean, I was sad that he was going to be gone, because you only get the one father. But I was relieved, because I always expected to get a call from the Philadelphia Police Department telling me that he'd had his throat slit by crack dealers or something.
Well, you say you never forgave your father for the way he treated you. us, the whole family. But the other members of an alcoholic's family are always making excuses, aren't they? They're always trying to cover up for him.
Yeah. Well, Irish people are hard, so we're not in the forgiveness business. So when people react to that and say, how could you not forgive your father once he tried to give up drinking? I'm not forgiven and I'm not forgetting. My sisters were even less forgiving than me because I think he was harder on them. And you can reach a point where, you know, I helped my father at the end. He was in the hospital. I made sure that he got the last rites. I was there. I didn't condemn him and I didn't confront him. But as I said in the book, he'd done bad things to God's children, and now God was doing bad things to him.
And your sister Eileen thought that he was inherently evil. At one point, you say that it was nice to know his antipathy towards you wasn't personal.
Yeah, he just. It was almost like it was electromagnetic, that there were all these excuses for his behavior because he supposedly had a metal plate in his head because he'd been shot as a kid. And then he'd gone AWOL when he had the dishonorable discharge. Supposedly he had been supervising his baby sister when she died in a fire when he was a little kid. So, and he had survived the Great Depression. Plus his father beat him. So whenever you were feeling sorry for yourself, you couldn't compete with this guy. I mean, game, set, and match. He had all the excuses.
And then your mother was not ideal either. How did they meet?
They met at a dance. Everybody met at a dance back then.
Were they ever happy together, do you think?
I don't think so. I think that my father probably enjoyed my mother's company more than she enjoyed his. Because my dad only wanted to stay home and drink. My mother liked to go out and dance. So until about 15 years ago when her knees gave out, I used to take her dancing sometimes. And I used to take her down to the casinos in Atlantic City, which was just about the only thing she ever enjoyed doing.
Had she come from a similar economic background?
She was slightly better off than my father, and that was part of the problem, was that when they got married, he wanted to move into one of those Philadelphia neighborhoods where the streets are really, really narrow and everybody sits out on their front stoop. My mother wanted no parts of that. My mother was a manic depressive, and she spent most of her adult life not being able to come to terms with her misfortune.
And she stayed married to him because that's what people did?
She was Catholic. You were supposed to stay married. There was a huge stigma attached to being divorced. She would never divorce him because Catholics didn't do that. But the one thing that my mother did do was when I was about 13, she went back to work, and that made it possible for us to get off the project and stay off the project because without two incomes, we could not have gotten out of the housing project.
And a centerpiece of the book is when your family had to leave your house and move into the East Falls housing project. I resist trying to pronounce the other name.
Schuylkill.
It's Schuylkill because it's a weird name.
It is.
A lot of letters that obviously are not pronounced. That was 1958?
59.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 8 going on 9.
And you could see more expensive, more luxurious houses from where you were living in the projects.
It was really
a resentment?
Oh, yeah. It was really funny because there was a fence. There was a train line right next to our house. So there was barbed wire to keep people from climbing onto the train line. But then further down the road, there wasn't any barbed wire. So it wasn't like they were trying to look out for everybody's kids. And on the hill overlooking the project were these things called the new homes. And they were these red brick homes. And I never went to visit them until about 5 years ago because they always seemed the place you didn't belong.
Now, Philadelphia also has a lot of poor black people. How at that time was poverty in regards to race? Was it similar whether you were white or black, or was there a difference?
It's always worse for black people. I mean, you know, look at the unemployment rate. It was always worse for black people. When we moved to the project, it was mostly white. There were some blacks. There were some Hispanics. There were a few people from Cambodia and places like that. There were some Native Americans. But it was more depressing. I mean, it was more like you went to the project and you knew you were finished. I mean, you were just trash. And then after we left that project became one of the worst projects in America. There were these two gigantic towers that they had that the police simply could not police. And they eventually closed those towers, but they kept the project open for another 20 years, even though the towers were unsafe to be in.
How were you able to leave?
We we left because my father got a job with the pretzel company, and then we started renting a house that we rented a house in this neighborhood that we thought was great, and then we found out that all the white people were moving out of that neighborhood. And in fact, the Monsignor at the church went, I found this out years later, a black friend of mine told me this, before we came, the Monsignor from the church went into the fourth, the seventh, and the eighth grades and told everybody, be nice to the Queen and kids because they're the first white people to move into the neighborhood in years. And they said this in front of black kids. There were black kids in those classes. And that was just like a classic Irish-American priest. That's the way they behaved.
Well, you grew up with a father who was an autodidact, and that probably was a key to your education as well. But how did you wind up becoming as funny as you haven't been funny during this conversation? This is not a funny topic. But I remember the first time I brought you to the 92nd Street Y with a group of humorists. You were filling in for somebody else. I can't remember who in the audience.
Calvin Trillin.
Calvin Trillin. And the audience was really disappointed. And then afterward, they all asked me, where did you find this guy? He's just so funny.
I'm Irish.
Is that it?
Yeah, well, it's genetically true. If you're Irish-American and you're not funny, they just leave you out in the stoop and let you freeze to death. You're not going to make it. Everybody in my family's funny. I mean, if you're born Irish-American, you're going to be depressed. You're going to have trouble with your father. You're going to have all kinds of issues with the church. You're probably going to have problems with alcohol, but you will be one hell of a storyteller.
Well, what do you think the legacy of your father in your youth has had for your adult life?
I was always fascinated by my father because the way my father used words was why I became a writer. He would get angry and he would dictate letters to the Evening Bulletin in Philadelphia, and he would say, more in sorrow than in anger, I take my pen in hand. And I just thought, if I could talk like that and write like that, I might be able to make a living doing this kind of stuff. And I was always fascinated by words. When you're poor, you have no house, you have no money, you have no car, you might have no future, but you have words. And if you can use words, you can succeed.
Do you think it also affected the way you related to your children? For example, many people who come out of families of the sort that you did become abusive as well, or become just as alcoholic, or they go in the opposite direction. They become the most loving, most sober person you can imagine.
I think my daughter would say I'm the most loving parent. I don't know if my son would say it, because relationships between fathers and sons always have that edge. But no, I always made my children feel that they were the most important thing in my life, because they were the most important thing in my life. I mean, I didn't care anywhere near as much about my career as I thought I would. When I was a kid, I thought if I could just be a successful writer. And I thought that way until I had my kids. And then after you have your kids, if you're any kind of parent, your career should come in about ninth place after your kids.
Joe Queenan's memoir, Closing Time, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.